Hello and welcome to this month's House Call. Our special guest this month is Nancy Bosker. She is the author of an excellent book on fundraising titled Go Fish, How to Catch and Keep Contributors. Nancy, I know we have seen each other and known each other for probably longer than either one of us wants to admit. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Glad to
I've not
be
only
here.
Read your book, but I've been at numerous seminars, training seminars, such as the campaigns and election seminars, where you've spoken, and I've never gone to one of your talks that I haven't learned something new or been reminded of something important that I had forgotten. So, you know, it's really great to have you with us today.
Well, you know, it's a snow day here in Washington, and it is a fabulous day because I can sit and talk on the phone today, and there will be no interruptions.
Excellent. And all I have is my dog in my office, so hopefully no rabbits will run by and interrupt us with that.
Oh, but good.
Let's get started right from the very beginning, and I know the answer to this, and probably most of the people know this is coming, but it never hurts to remind them. Tell us, what is the number one secret to fundraising?
Well, at the end of the day, it's got to be you have to ask. You cannot text and tweet your way to millions. You have to pick up the phone or schedule meetings, make sure you've done your homework. It's why God created Google, so you can find out as much information as you can about a potential donor. And then you have to make the call. And most candidates, you give them the option. You know, cold call someone, ask for $2,600, which is the top amount in a federal race, or go to the dentist, have all of your teeth pulled, have it all done without anesthesia, and throw in root canals. And most people would much prefer going to the dentist. So when I work with candidates, our number one goal is I'm going to teach you how to ask for money even if you hate to. There are some solid steps that we go through, but it really is about relationship building. And the more you know about a donor and know what this donor cares about, the better able you're going to be to get a contribution.
You and I, that is so important. You and I remember days before Al Gore invented the internet and the people, and the challenge it was to try to find information about a potential donor that now is right at your fingertips on Facebook, Google searches, LinkedIn. It's amazing what resources are available to candidates today that they just don't use.
They don't. They really... Information is power, and I remind my clients that your heart is closer to your wallet than your mind. So I have to win over your heart if I'm going to encourage, inspire, persuade you to give a donation. You can't go in and look like you're the smartest one in the room. One of the things that I've learned along the way is there's a saying that says God gave us two ears and one mouth for a reason. So you can't just go in there and bulldoze your potential donor. You have to listen very carefully. And if that person is going to be is telling you that education is the most important issue of the day, don't start going in on your five-point plan to ban abortions in the United States. You have to be very cognitive of what the donor is after and what you can do as that candidate and future elected official to help achieve those goals.
In Go Fish, you outlined the three basic ways the methods that campaigns use to raise money. Could you go through those real quickly and just give a basic outline of each?
Sure. You know, most people give, and it's why it's very important, and we'll talk about in a little bit about why it's important to diversify your fundraising techniques. There are many ways to raise money in a campaign. At the top, it's always making the ask, that one-on-one personal connection, whether it is the candidate making a call or the candidate recruits a finance committee, which are your friends, neighbors, and colleagues to help agree to raise a set amount of money. As I say, an achievable goal with a deadline. Because if you don't have a goal and a deadline, that's not going to work. But that one-on-one ask is so critical. People want that personal contact. The second, you know, people who go to fundraising events. And that really is more of a social aspect. Fundraising events work because of friend-to-friend fundraising. It's friends asking their friends, neighbors, and colleagues to buy a ticket to a house party at Chuck Muth's house, right? There's that they want some value for their donation. And as human beings, we like to be part of a group. So that's why we have donor clubs, where we want to make people feel special. These aren't the people that are going to be calling you and wanting a passport, you know, emergency passport for their child, because they're not a big donor. But those mid-sized donors who go to events really want to have that. They're also perks, and that is, you know, something of value, whether it's a mug or cufflinks or whatever it is. And they also like to be invited to go to events events where their friends are going to be. So then at the other kinds of people who give really are mainly our low-dollar donors, and those are the ones who give through primarily direct mail, although telemarketing certainly works in larger campaigns. And these are people that tend to be our most issue-oriented donors. This is the little old lady who gets a piece of direct mail and decides to give a contribution because she wants to make the world better for her children and grandchildren. So in campaigns, you need to become a list collector. I've never met a list that didn't bring me one or more of three things: a vote, a volunteer, or a donation. So whether it's pro-life, homeschool, pro-gun, school teachers, whatever that issue-related donor may be advocating, we need to make that personal connection through that kind of communication. These are folks that really don't want to go to events anymore. The average donor through direct mail is in the 70s for both the Republican and the Democratic Party. It's like my mother. You know, she's 88. She doesn't want to go to events anymore, but she will be a consistent donor through direct mail. So it's very important that you analyze who are your donors and what is going to be really that connection so they'll be inspired to give you money.
You mentioned finance committees, and I know that a lot of candidates have this idea that if they just recruit other people to go out and raise money for them, you know, that'll be they won't have to do the fundraising themselves. And there's a lot of confusion, I think, on exactly what a finance committee is, what it does, and how to form one. Could you go through that a little bit for a lot of our candidates?
Sure. When we look at an overall fundraising plan, you know, where's the money going to come from? There's no formula, and I know candidates always ask questions and want to know what percentage should come from this, and we always have to say every campaign's different. But looking back at successful campaigns, we know that a good finance committee can raise 60% or so of your overall campaign budget. So a finance committee is when you recruit your friends, neighbors, and colleagues, and we'll talk about how I recruit them in a second, but you recruit them and you actually ask them to be part of your sales team for your campaign. It's very important that we give them an achievable goal and a deadline, because when I have spoken to people about why didn't your finance committee work, and it's always, well, you know, we had a bunch of friends, we had some lunch, we talked about issues, and I said, yeah, well, you never really asked them to do anything. It can't be, hey, Chuck, can you raise some money for me? It has to be something that's achievable. So can you help me raise $5,000 in the next 2 months? Can you help me raise $10,000 during the next 3 months? And it has to be something that is attainable. It may be a little bit of a reach, but you're reaching out to people who think that, yes, this is possible. And you need to give them a deadline because, again, many campaigns just say, hey, Tom, will you be on the finance committee? And there's no measurement there. So when I work with campaigns, and we take a look at, okay, let's recruit a finance committee. When I do that, I recruit three ways. First of all, I look for people in certain occupations, right? So I take a look at someone's Rolodex, Christmas or holiday card list, LinkedIn, and I'll ask questions. Who is your local realtor, the home builder, the car dealer, the independent insurance agent? These people who have a specific occupation bring two things to the table for me. First of all, membership list. I've never met an independent insurance agent who didn't know almost every other independent insurance agent almost in the world. So they have their own spheres of influence and networks to work on behalf of your candidacy. Second, these folks bring access, potential access to PAC money. You're never going to get a nickel from the Nevada Realtors Association if you don't have a local realtor advocating for you. So we're looking for that relationship building. Good PAC fundraising starts at home. So you have to figure out, okay, who do we know who is very involved politically, and the realtors are the most politically involved organization in the country. They're the number one in political activity. So you need to know those folks. So we look at occupation. Second, I look at region. I want to make sure that I have people who know lots of people, right, have a strong Rolodex, very active in church, community activities, nonprofits, who can pick up the phone and have their own personal spheres of influence. So let's say I want to have someone that lives, we'll just use Arlington, Virginia. Arlington, Virginia is a big place, so I want to make sure someone is from Clarendon, Ballston, Courthouse, because those are neighborhoods. In a more rural area, I may organize by county. In a city like Las Vegas, I may do it by neighborhood or by suburb. But I want someone who's well-connected, who can raise money from that part of the area, or from that part of their community. And then third, I'm looking for people who are only going to give to me because they support me on a certain issue. So this is where I find my gun owners, people in the pro-life community, homeschooling, again, people who have their own networks, spheres of influence, who are really supporting you because of your stand on a specific issue. So we take a look at this name, and we put together a list of names, and one of the questions is, well, how many people do we need on a finance committee? And I tend to say, well, kind of the more the merrier, because you need to over-recruit. I would rather have 30 people recruited for a campaign and giving each one a goal of raising $2,000, knowing that maybe 25 will achieve that goal, than to have only asked 4 people and maybe 1 person achieving that goal. So it does need to be diversified, it needs to be bigger, and you need someone who provides concierge service to those folks, because if you've got an insurance agent, you're going to have to monitor, okay, here's the email that we have approved as a campaign, it has proper disclaimers on there, before you can send it out to your other insurance agent friends. Here's a packet on how to host a house party. So I give everyone the tools they need so they can achieve their fundraising goals.
So I agree 100%. If you make it easy, that is a key. Because a lot of these folks that you're going to recruit, if you're new to politics, a lot of your associates and friends are going to be new too. They're not going to have any idea how to do this, and the easier you make it for them to take the fear and uncertainty out of it, the better off you're going to be. You did mention finance plans. How important is it to have a written finance plan? And for someone who's never developed one for a campaign, what are the key ingredients to a finance plan that will actually work for you?
Sure. There's my college roommate's daughter is a dietitian, and she always says, if it's not documented, it didn't happen. You can't just say, yep, I want to raise $100,000 and not figure out how am I going to do it? How much can the candidate put in the race? How much do we think a finance committee can raise? What about fundraising events? What about direct mail? What about social media? So we have to sit down and figure out, okay, what is it we need to raise? So the first thing you need to do is you need a political plan. I can't figure out how much money I need to raise unless I know how much do things cost. Do I have to get cable television? Do I need radio? What about targeted direct mail? How much, staffing? How much is this going to cost me to put on both the, we call it the Cadillac version of the campaign, the Taurus version, and, of course, the Yugo version, right? What's the bare bones? But we need to have some idea, because then I can write a plan that addresses, okay, this is what's going to have to happen if you're going to be able to raise $100,000 rather than $50,000. So you write, and the other places you find this from going back and looking at past election results. How much did the campaign cost in this district in 2010, 2012? How did they spend the money? Were they successful? Were they not successful? Did they buy, spend all their money on yard signs, which at the end of the campaign still sat in the candidate's garage? So you need to take a look at, you know, at the past, because past performance often is a predictor of future success. So once we get those numbers down, we sit down and have a frank conversation with the candidate. We hope a campaign manager is there, maybe some people who've worked in politics before. You don't want this crowd to be too big, but you need to sit down and figure out, can we really raise the amount of money we think we can to run the Cadillac version of the campaign? Then we start filling the numbers in, and I actually have a template that my late colleague Dan Morgan put together probably more than 20 years ago that helps people. It's a finance plan template that you sit down and you figure out, okay, if who are the first 100 people that I can ask for money for my campaign? And I make people write these names and phone numbers down. So the more prep I have, the better chance I'm going to have to actually achieve my fundraising goals.
Is that template included in the Go Fish book?
You know what? It's not, but I can certainly make that available to those that want to buy a copy of the book.
Okay. We'll figure that out. We'll add that in. Now, in the book, in Go Fish, you also write about something called, quote, segmenting the donor universe. Explain what that means, because I know that's an important part of your fundraising efforts.
Well, and it's one of the reasons I named the book what I did, Go Fish, How to Catch and Keep Contributors, because fundraising is a lot like fishing. If I wanted to go and catch a giant marlin or other large fish, I would have to go to Florida, I'd have to get special bait, special equipment, I'd have to hire the skipper and Gilligan, and we'd have to go out, and it would take a longer, you know, we'd have to be out there all day with a very specific strategy to catch the big fish. It's the same in fundraising. Major donors, those that, and you have to determine what a major donor is based on your state law and your capability, but they need special treatment. They need special bait, special attention. But no less important in the world of fishing or fundraising is you have to cast a very wide net. So you can pick up small and medium donors and fish. Because I want to make sure I give every potential donor the opportunity to invest in my campaign. One reason that self-funders often fail, unless you live in New York City or New Jersey, as I lovingly say, is that they haven't had to ask people to invest. If somebody's given you a dollar, you know, I always say the little old lady that gives you a dollar and a piece of direct mail is going to be the first one to vote for you on election day. She has skin in the game. So it's important that you ask and ask often. Don't make the assumption that because somebody lives in not the nicest house or may drive an old car, that that person shouldn't be asked. It's a little arrogant to make that determination. Donors are actually flattered if you ask them for more money than they can even afford to give. And again, it goes back to the worst thing somebody could tell you is no. I'd rather ask for $1,000 and walk out with $500 because I'm Monty Hall, and this is Let's Make a Deal, than to have asked somebody for just $10 or $15 in a piece of direct mail. So it's important to know that negotiation is fine.
So you said something about the $1, and if somebody gives you $1, they're a vote for you as well. But I've had a lot of success in working with candidates who have never raised money before, and it scares the living daylights out of them, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Almost anybody can ask anybody for $1. And
mm-hmm.
It's not the dollar amount that's so important for first-time candidates. It's just simply getting over the fear of asking. And just, if you've never done this before, just everybody you talk to about your campaign, just at the end of the conversation, you say, hey, could you give $1? Because not only have you secured a voter, but it will become easier and easier and easier for you to start adding zeros. You get comfortable asking for a dollar. Next thing you know, you're asking for 10, then you're asking for 100 and 1,000, and it really doesn't matter as long as you get used to asking for the money.
Well, you're absolutely right. And it's all those first month or so when you're a candidate, it is difficult. But the more people you ask, the more money you're going to raise. Terry McAuliffe, who is now the governor of Virginia, said back in 2007 that any time you make a phone call, your response rate will go up 5 times. It's still that personal connection. It is a lot harder to turn down somebody who is a friend. So my goal is to make every potential contributor my friend by figuring out what is it that we have in common. Because you can find one degree of separation between you and almost every person you meet by asking questions and doing your research ahead of time. And if I walk into somebody's office and there's the University of Nevada, is it the Rebels is the basketball team?
UNLV, correct.
Yeah, UNLV Rebels. Gosh, if there's memorabilia around the office, talk about how's that basketball team doing, right? You need to be observant. Take a look at the family photos. What's your dream for your children? Oh, here's why I'm running. Here's why I can win. Here's why people are going to vote for me. And here's why you need to invest in my campaign today.
And it's so important. It does not have to be issue-related or political connection. Any connection that puts you on a one-to-one personal relationship with that individual, people give money and they vote for people that are like them and that they like. And anything that you can find in common helps break that ice and move you to that next step. Now, tell us a little bit about fundraising. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, but you're just so right there. We're in a nation where I'm working in a district now where there's more registered independents than Democrats and Republicans. People, tend to eschew political parties. Well, and really on both sides of the spectrum, 20% are solid Dems, 20% are solid Republicans, but that leaves a lot of potential in the middle. And I've always said friendship trumps political party. Unless somebody is very hardcore. And just an interesting story, when Rick Perry ran for president, for that nanosecond, I knew that Rick Perry would raise more money than even Mitt Romney in that quarter because Rick Perry went to Texas A&M. So when he did, I think he reported $18 million in his first quarter. So the Wall Street Journal reporters started calling donors who had given $5,000. And called some guy, we'll call him Bubba. So, Bubba, I just saw that you had given $5,000 to Rick Perry. And the guy goes off, right? I'm a Democrat. I hate Republicans. I think they're evil. They hate immigrants, blah, blah, blah. And the Wall Street Journal, are you like the Bubba Jones that just gave $5,000? Do I have the right one? He says, well, damn straight. Rick Perry's an Aggie and we're fraternity brothers. Of course I'm going to give him money.
But similarly, I read a story not too long ago about one of Hollywood's rare, a Republican conservative actress who voted for and supported liberal Jerry Brown, a Democrat candidate for governor. And the question was, well, why? You're such a well-known conservative Republican. Did you vote for Jerry Brown? And I think the story was way back when they were kids, she asked her friends to help her move, and the only one to show up that day was Jerry Brown. And so she ended up voting for him just because he was the only guy who came and helped put furniture in the moving van for her.
Never, never, ever underestimate that part. And I think sometimes we put on our conservative or our Republican hats and we think we can only ask people who are like us. And people remember kindnesses. And I'd love for you to send me that story because I always have to emphasize that because people don't believe me.
Okay, Nancy, how about events? I know a lot of candidates, that's the first thing they think of when it comes to fundraising for their campaigns. And I think it has more to do with they don't have to ask somebody so much directly, face-to-face, for a contribution.
Exactly.
A lot of
candidates think, oh, let me just send out some invitations, and we'll text them and tweet them and do a Facebook page, and people will just show up by the hundreds, and I'll never have to speak to anyone. And it's a real problem. That is just a guarantee for failure.
For candidates who are going to do some events, and events are good, I mean, because there are some donors who want to have that social interaction with other people. Give us an idea of what are some of the secrets to making sure that you put on a good fundraising event. And I know you put emphasis on that D in fundraising.
Yes, that the D does stand for dollars in fundraising. Well, there's two reasons they don't work, and let's just address those. The first is out-of-control overhead. Candidates kind of get in their heads, I've got to rent out the Ritz-Carlton with the beautiful chandeliers, and there has to be a band and fancy invitations and lobster and open bars. And then they do the math when the event's over, and they go, oops, we forgot to make money. So you must keep an eye on the overhead. In nonprofit world, the industry standard is about 30%, which is why I think a lot of nonprofits just do not make the money that they need to. You really need to keep that overhead to 12 to 15%. And if you're a candidate, you need to focus on house parties. You need to focus on friends, neighbors, and colleagues who will host something at their home, because that friend-to-friend fundraising, when you invite friends to your home, that really is going to be your best bet for an event that will make money. You don't have to, just don't get in your head that you must go to the Ritz-Carlton or no one's going to come. The friend-to-friend fundraising is the critical ingredient of a successful party, and you can keep your cost to a minimum if you do a house party. But
is there a secret way to ask people to host parties at their home? I think that's probably something that's unusual, that most first-time candidates clearly won't have had experience doing that, asking a friend or family member to host a party. Is there a right way or a wrong way to do that?
Well, I think that there's going to be a lot of people that go, what can I do to help the campaign? And so you can say, could you please just invite people from your own sphere of influence over to your home? One of the things we learned, and I always knew anecdotally, and we learned this from the Obama campaign, is that friends are twice as likely to do something when asked than just if a stranger asks. So they really went out and figured out, okay, if Chuck was supporting Obama, we know this is never going to happen. If Chuck's supporting Obama and his friend Bill isn't, if Chuck asked Bill, hey, it would mean a lot to me if you supported the president, Bill's going to be twice as likely to do it. So I think in the world of house parties, what can you do to make this as fun and as easy as possible on the host? And you just so one of the things that I detail in the book is there's no place like home to raise money. I mean, it just makes such sense. The campaign needs to help coordinate, but you really need to be working on that host. Who are your friends? Who do you know from church, from civic clubs, from the veterans organizations? Who are people that will come over and want to meet a refreshing candidate? So there are some steps you can take, and I actually have a house party kit that people follow, so they can make this where my host is worrying about, and I really want my host not worrying about what to serve. I want my host calling their friends and asking them to come. And that really is the key to success, is that personal phone call, which really leads us into the second part besides out-of-control overhead, and that is lack of organization. Ticket sellers sell tickets, not fancy invitations, not sexy guest speakers. You really have to have friends reaching out to their own friends, neighbors, and colleagues. In fact, again, the number of people who tell me, Nancy, I sent out 2,000 invitations and nobody came. And I go, of course nobody's going to come, because nobody made a phone call follow-up. I mean, it really is that important that you're on the telephone working. And we just, had somebody I was helping in Florida when I asked the person who had hosted a house party, how was this a success? What made this event a success? And they said, well, Nancy, it was your advice of picking up the telephone and calling people. It's a lot harder to turn down a friend than it is a stranger, and that's why you need to have that direct interaction. People can delete emails, throw away invitations, but it's a lot harder to actually turn down a friend who calls.
Yeah, I remember you when I came to one of your classes at the Leadership Institute a long time ago, longer than either of us probably care to reveal at this point, but that was something that stuck with me, Nancy, all the time. Tickets don't sell, invitations don't sell tickets, people sell tickets. And
right.
You just have to pick up the phone. Sometimes all it is just a matter of saying, did you receive the invitation?
Right.
It then gets them to the point where they have to say, yes, I did, and they feel obligated to give you an answer, whether they're coming or not. So it's not really difficult. It's not a hard sell, is it?
No, and, you know, it's interesting. One of our mutual friends, Richard Norman, who's just one of the top fundraisers, in fact, was named the American Association of Political Consultants Fundraiser for the Year last year. You know, he's on a board of an organization, a nonprofit called Youth for Tomorrow. Now, Youth for Tomorrow was founded by former Redskins coach Joe Gibbs. And every year, Richard emails me, sends me an invitation, delete, throw away. But every year, he picks up the phone. And he'll call me, and he'll say, Nancy, can I put you down for $100 or $200 for this year's event? And every year, I end up giving $200 or so to an organization. I have no clue what they do. I'll never go to one of their balls. I just have no desire. Yet, I give money to him every year. And what's funny about that is I was on a panel with another consultant that said, you know what, Nancy? I give money to Richard Norman every year, too, for Youth for Tomorrow, and I don't have a clue what they do.
It's really important
for people to understand friends help other friends, and that's and part of that is the trust asset. Your neighbors trust you. You have friends from church. Who's going to help you make this event a success?
One last part on events, and then we'll move on to the last part because I know we're running short on time. Any advice on how to set ticket prices? Because I know that drives a lot of candidates right. They don't want to charge too much and drive people away, but they don't want to charge too little and leave money on the table. Any advice on that?
Well, you work with your host. If you're having a house party, you work with the host on what will the market bear. So when I've done events in rural Nebraska, there are some communities, like a larger town, that might be $150 a couple. Some towns, they say, you know, I really can't charge my friends more than $20. But you also, you have ticket prices, the price of admission, but you make sure you find other people to help host who may put in $250 or $500 that really, that helps underwrite the cost of the event. More importantly, I always have somebody in the crowd after the candidate has spoken say, you know what, I'm so impressed by what Chuck has said tonight that I am, you know, even though we spent $100 to come here, I am happy to send. I'm going to write another check for $250, and I urge everyone to meet that. You know, it just, that little bit of another ask makes a big difference in a campaign. Because there's a lot of peer pressure involved. It's like church. If somebody puts in a nickel, the next person's going to put in a quarter.
Oh, yes. It's peer pressure.
It is.
Absolutely.
And so you can't be scared to do that. Because at the end of the day, if you don't have the money to run a campaign, you're going to lose. People who tell me, oh, we don't need to raise money, we're going to run a grassroots campaign, are often the ones who are losers.
Now, when I read Go Fish, when it first came out and you wrote it, the only thing that you had in there was internet fundraising, primarily email fundraising. It was just a short paragraph or chapter as well because it was in such its infancy. This was before Facebook and Twitter exploded.
Yes.
Give me an update. I think you told me that you've added to the latest version of the book a whole section on social media. Give us a little flavor of how that has developed.
Well, it's been great. One of my grad assistants actually wrote an update to the book for her thesis. Lucky me. So we both won on this one. So there's an additional 20 pages on social marketing. It has changed quite a bit. When John McCain, who was really the first one to use quite a bit of websites, when he raised $6 million back in 2000, it was like unheard of at the time. But every time he would give a speech, he would go, visit johnmccain.com today to donate money. Well, now we have found that most people give money because their friends have sent them an email asking that they give money. Just like everything else, it goes down to personal. So, if Chuck, if you sent a email to someone asking for money, chances are, again, your friends will do what you've asked them to do. That is a much better technique now than driving people to websites. Yes, you still need to have a website, but more importantly, it has to be, will you please give to my friend? Because it all goes back to friend-to-friend fundraising.
Just in perspective, you mentioned John McCain raised, what was it, $6 million in 2000? And then let's go forward a dozen years. Do you know off the top of your head how much did approximately did Barack Obama raise online?
Well, I want to say, you know, they both he raised $1 billion in this last presidential campaign. I cannot remember the exact 2012 numbers, but I will tell you in 2008 he raised about $400 million of the $800 million he raised came from the internet. Now, what was lost in this, you know, in all of those facts was that the McCain campaign raised more than $300 million online, if I recall correctly. So they were nipping at Obama's heels. It just kind of got lost in the Obama, you know, watershed.
Yeah, but still, we went and, okay, let's say from 2000 to 2008, John McCain himself went from raising $6 million online to $300 million online.
Right.
I mean, that should give everybody listening to this a sense of just how important social media and online fundraising is today. It's not something you can just take for granted or ignore. It's something you really have to actively go out there and pursue, right?
You do, but I also want to just point out, too, that when I go through, here are eight ways to raise money in a political campaign, social marketing is still number eight. Even less than 10% of all money raised in a campaign comes from the internet. And the only reason it's at 10% is because it included the Romney and the Obama numbers. So do you need to have – no one needs to operate in a silo. You can't just say go to a website and contribute now. You have to be proactive with emails. Everyone should have a Square or another credit card reader, and every person on the finance committee should have a Square on his or her iPhone or Droid or iPad, because fundraising is an impulse buy. So when you go see somebody and say, hey, I want to give money to Darcy's campaign, well, you know, I don't have my checkbook with me. That's fine. Will you use your debit or credit card? We can take that contribution right now. So the internet and social marketing gives us this, you know, just instant access. And with Square, money is in your bank account the very next day for just 2.75%. That's it on the fees.
A decision made on donating is a decision that probably means that you won't get the donation. That's why it's so important to take it when you can get it immediately if you can.
Exactly. The number of people that go, you know, one of the three biggest lies, the check's in the mail.
Right.
And so you need to do something about that. So you need to be much more proactive.
Well, Nancy, this has been fantastic. This has been extremely helpful to candidates. I know a lot of them are new and haven't done fundraising, and anything you can do to help them get beyond that hurdle is extremely helpful. So thank you for your time. Again, I read the book Go Fish years ago, and it was extremely helpful to me. You've updated it now. Tell us again, how can people get a copy of the book?
77 pages, and my website is nancybosker.com, and it's nancybosker.com. and you can go there, and there is a special price of $32 if you click down that says buy the book. People have to buy the book generally for $50, but there is a special price for $32. You just have
Excellent.
To click on.
Well, that's fantastic. Nancy, all the best. Thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
This has
been
Dr. Chuck
Moose. Glad to help, Chuck.
Thank you all for listening in on this month's campaign house call for the campaign doctor, and we'll talk to you next month.